Hi, this is Pastor Chris, and welcome to Strength for Today from Living Hope Baptist Church in Geneva, New York. Today is Thursday, April 30th, 2020. When, at the age of 20, I moved to New York City, I was warned I would see a lot of weird people and strange things. I must admit that I was, frankly, a little bit disappointed to find that most of the people there were just, well, normal, going about their lives, going to work, raising families, pursuing hobbies. Oh, there were exceptions, of course, the people who lived in the cardboard boxes on the streets and survived by eating leftovers given to them by passersby, and the movie stars and the TV stars you occasionally saw getting out of the stretched limos. But by and large, most people were pretty much like me, just trying to get by. But then my depression flared up, and I found myself for the first time on the unit of a mental hospital. And as terrible as that was emotionally, I have to admit I still found it fascinating. Here was the New York City of Coney Island freak show fantasy. Okay, I got to pause here and mention that nothing I say here is intended to demean the humanity or suffering of anyone. I recognize each story represents the real pain of a real family and the pain of their family and friends. But please take it as a sort of gallows humor prevalent within the hospitals, a method by which patients try to cope and to whistle in the dark. And if I describe any individual as weird, it is with full awareness and acceptance that someone out there may be speaking of my case and how very weird I was. After a week or two on the unit, I had learned the names of most of the patients and the backstories of the more interesting ones. Now, the names and the details have been altered here to protect privacy. But let me walk you down the hall from my room to the dining room for breakfast. Typical morning, you know. I'd get up and rearrange my hospital gown. Wasn't allowed clothing yet, just non-slip socks and a gown. Well, they gave me actually two gowns, which was nice, because if you wore one backwards, you could cover up completely. It's a little more modest. Not terribly comfortable, but at least it is modest. So I start to leave the room, and as I did, I would see Ted on the other side of the room, standing by the window, looking out at the river. A chunky, strong kid of 18 or 19 with dark, spiky hair. He'd be clenching and unclenching his fist as he stared blankly out the window, with tape around each of his fingers, white surgical tape. I asked him once why he taped his fingers, and he glanced at them and said, "'Cause if I don't, I'll hit someone." Well, I never saw him in regular clothes. I guess I didn't want him to get out. I sort of want to keep him locked down. Anyways, I'd leave my room and step out in the hallway. And coming down the hallway toward me would be Lily. I remember the day Lily came into the hospital, just a day or two after me. At the time, I thought she'd kind of looked hot. And I remember thinking, I want to get to know her. But I quickly flushed that idea away. Within a couple days, she had moved into a bizarre alternate reality. And here she was, walking toward me. For some reason, Lily got to have semi-normal clothing. Didn't really understand that, but whatever. For her, that meant a mauve smoking jacket. And then also a beret that she'd wear on top of her head, sort of to the side. The sash on the jacket looked like that one of those ties on an old heavy drapery, one of the ones with a tassel at each end. She had stopped showering since she had entered the hospital. I don't know why, but maybe it was her Mediterranean heritage, because the facial hair and that leg hair had sprouted like one of those yards that the owners forgot to mow. Her shoulder-length hair lay limp and greasy against the sides of her face. This particular day, she had decided to paint her face in vivid shades of purples, reds, and blues, the whole face. And as she wanders by, she seems oblivious to my casual, "Morning, Lily," and she just murmurs something about going to the day room, pounding on the beater piano there, and talking with the music people who live over the East River. A bit further down the hallway, I passed Lenny. I don't really get Lenny. I didn't really get Bill or Lily either, but oh well. Anyways, Lenny looked outwardly fairly normal. Maybe 20, tall, skinny kid, normally dressed, clean-shaven, short haircut. But it was his affect that was all bizarre. He'd walk along the side of the corridor, never venturing a foot from the wall. And most of the time, he'd keep a hand cupped over the eye closest to the corridor, and he'd walk very slowly, a bit stooped, with a shuffling gait. Friendly enough, though, I'd say, "Hey, Lenny, how's it going?" And then I'd stand there and wait and give him a chance to respond. It always took a long time for him to stammer out, Chris, morning. But this, I understood, wasn't caused by some sort of speech impediment, at least one he'd been born with. Kind of ran around the unit that he had some kind of weird psychological problem. At least that, as I said, was the gossip. I never actually found out the real scoop because I never could have a real conversation with Lenny. No one else ever did, it seemed, either. So people just sort of made up their own stories to explain his behavior. And let's be honest, they probably all those stories were wrong. Well, turning left, I would near the dining hall, and there I'd see Rosita coming towards me. She was a short, friendly, talkative, normalish woman of 30-something, dark curly hair and dark eyes. I think she was Puerto Rican. She looks normal and all, but I don't like sitting and talking with her. She seems fixated on her bowels. I haven't had a bowel movement in this many days, and I'm so constipated. She'd ended up in the mental hospital because her husband couldn't stand it anymore. He drove her in when she started to drink glasses of mineral oil. Gross. And now she was being watched carefully by the staff to make sure she didn't violate her quote-unquote bathroom restriction. Incidentally, a few weeks later, Rosita came to us and told us that she was being transferred to a medical unit. Turned out, after a month of psychological exploration to uncover the cause of her bowel obsession, a blood draw or some other test had shown that she had multiple sclerosis. I guess she really was backed up. Anyways, okay, so I'd reached the dining hall and I'd look in. Family-style seating, you know, four to a table, family-style. Yeah, Adam's family. Anyways, there was Marjorie, plain, crabby woman in her 30s who was always so suicidal that she was on a 24-hour one-on-one. That meant that there was always a staff member with her, and that if you sat at her table, you had to sit with the staff member, too. A person whose sole job for that day was to keep Marjorie from killing herself. Maybe this will come as a shock to you, but I didn't find her to be a lot of fun. She was a bit of a downer. And then, over there on the left side, was that elderly lady who was so nice and friendly and talkative when she first came in. But since she's been getting those shock treatments, she's been in a bit of a stupor now. Drools a little, too. I think they may have forgotten to put the dentures back in after the last treatment. And next to her, there's Reuben. Reuben's a kid from the Bronx who a few months ago was at the top of his class in the charter school, the science one. But he's now primarily concerned with whether he gets as many stewed prunes as the other patients get. He says, "I need them," he tells everyone willing to listen. "Otherwise, my antidepressants stop me up." Well, you get the picture. There wasn't much to do on the unit, especially in the evenings. Most of the time, I'd just hang out in the common room that looked out over the river. And most of the time, I would sit with two other patients, Nana and Tracy. From a physical standpoint, these two looked like a female version of Laurel and Hardy. Nana was the heavy-set one, and Tracy was the thin one. I cannot see Nana in my memory as standing. No, I see her only at a table in the common room, seated, working on a jigsaw puzzle. She was heavy, dark, and thick, very Italian, with lots of gray hair and a diamond ring on every pudgy finger. She chain-smoked, and this had turned her voice gravelly. You know, her comments were morbid and sarcastic, but they were witty. She had a dark, clever sense of humor. I really enjoyed listening to her stories of life in New Jersey. She was in the hospital because she had attempted suicide, and she lamented her failure. "How was I supposed to know," she'd say, "how long that stupid rat poison would take, or that the doctors would guess why I was sick?" I guess she'd been adding rat poison to her sandwiches each day in increasing portions, until she ended up in the ER and was committed to the psych unit. I told her I thought that was a bit wimpy, kind of a passive way to try to kill herself off, but she actually didn't disagree. She didn't even try to deny the obvious. It's like when I escaped from the hospital a short time later and went to a nearby bridge to jump off and commit suicide, only to find all the sidewalks were temporarily barricaded and then to find myself back on the unit. "Yeah, you're dumb," she said. "First, you didn't need to go to the bridge to kill yourself. You should have just jumped in front of a car. And second, if you had jumped, you'd find yourself just swimming back to shore. Yeah, you're dumb." Yeah, I enjoyed Nana. And Nana's counterpart was Tracy. Whereas in my memory, I see Nana seated, slumped over a puzzle. I see Tracy walking slowly down the hall, her arms wrapped tightly around herself and her eyes cast down to the floor. Tracy had battled anorexia most of her life, and though she had given birth to two kids, she still looked, at this point, a little like a cadaver, like one of those people in Auschwitz. Oh, I know what you're thinking. Surely she could not be that thin. Surely she could not have looked that bad. But trust me, she did. She was, even down to the skull-like face and the sunken eyes. In addition, she was a cutter. She, unlike Nana, had never attempted suicide. She didn't slice her wrists because she wanted to end her life. She sliced them up because she had some sort of weird physical, some weird emotional reason, a desire to feel the enormous pain in a physical way. all that emotional pain inside of her, she wanted just to be seen somehow, so she cut herself. It was the result, I think, if I remember correctly, of some horrific child abuse during her adolescence. Well, and Tracy, she too was clever and witty and smart, morbid and sarcastic, like Nana, and fun to listen to. So I'd sit with them, and we'd spend that night talking each night. Now, I learned the hard way, though, that making friends on the unit was tough. Apart from losing several friends ultimately to suicide, I did occasionally have to deal with unexpected hardships. A situation with Tracy like that came up one evening. I was headed back to my room to go to sleep, so it must have been around midnight. Walked down the hallway from the common room toward the dining room. Ways down the hallway, I saw Tracy leaning against the wall in the semi-darkness. And as I passed, I said, "Hey." She glanced over at me, and I noticed that her face appeared, if possible, even more pale than usual. "What's up?" I asked. In reply, she just held out her arm. Bloody hand towel was wrapped around her forearm, and it was soaked red with blood. "What'd you do?" I asked. She didn't answer me. I'm not even sure she actually heard me. I went to the nurse's station. I called the attendant, and he rushed over, and they took her off to the ER. A few days later, she's back, seated next to me, watching Nona work on a puzzle. "What exactly did you do?" I asked. "Well," she answered, I broke open one of those razors they gave me in the shower, and then I sliced my arm from the wrist to almost the elbow. "But why?" "'Cause I couldn't handle the pain inside anymore. I needed to do something about it, and this gave me something I could see." "Were you trying to kill yourself?" I asked. No. I've done this before. I knew where to avoid, to cut, to avoid that artery. I'm pretty good at it. I've done it a bunch of times." And I knew that was true because I'd seen all the scars. Creepy, right? Downright creepy. I mean, really crazy. All this stuff. And the scary part is that to hear people talk about this stuff, some of it seemed to make sense. Crazy and scary. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about something that sounds almost as crazy and scary, like something out of a mental unit. He talks about reaching in and plucking out an eyeball and throwing it away. And he speaks of choosing to slice off your own hand. Some of the stories I heard regularly in mental hospitals involved male patients, if you can believe it, who cut off their own genitalia. And on occasion, this very scripture passage would be brought up and discussed. Now that I read the verses again, I wonder why these guys were cutting off their genitalia. If the verse was their justification, it made more sense to rip out an eye or cut off a hand. But anyhow, so we talk about such things, and I remember thinking how crazy that sounded. And then a guy that got brought into the ER of a hospital I was actually in, having done that very thing. Wow. I have to admit, I wish I could have talked to him. Unfortunately, I never had that chance. I just wish I had. But anyways, I remember thinking at that time how fortunate it was that I was not that crazy. But Jesus, in this section of the sermon, says it is better to do these acts for righteousness' sake than to not do them and end up in hell. Okay, I admit, I put in the words for righteousness' sake. What is the real context? The real context is lust and adultery. Jesus is talking about a man looking at a woman with sexual desire, a woman who is not his wife. And Jesus is addressing the inner thought, the inner life of that man. In doing so, he expands the definition of adultery to include this sort of looking. Against this sin, this looking, he exhorts drastic action, action that to a watching world may appear crazy. Because of spiritual realities, he suggests a believer may take steps that to non-believers would look crazy. But is he actually exhorting followers to maim themselves? No, I don't think so. I think his point is that believers must take sin seriously, that they must recognize that it springs from the heart, and that they must take decisive actions to address and eradicate it. Underlying this exhortation is Jesus' confirmation of hell's existence. He affirms hell's existence, and he confirms the thought that hell is a terrible place to which you do not wish to be consigned. In fact, he implies that hell is such a horrific place to go, that it is better to take outwardly crazy action in this world than to adopt a sane manner of life that ends in fiery torment. And what is the type of crazy action he advocates? the avoidance of sin by the identification and eradication of the avenues by which temptation enters the eye and is acted upon the hand. What is it again? The avoidance of sin by the identification and eradication of the avenues by which temptation enters the eye and is acted upon the hand. That Jesus is speaking figuratively to illustrate the importance of dealing with sin becomes clear when we consider the end results in those who actually literally have done these things, have plucked out their eyes or cut off their hands, or even in the weirder case, the removal of genitalia. In each case, the ability and the temptation to sin remained. Well, of course it did. We all know it would. That's so obvious that even we crazies in the mental unit laughed at those poor souls who sought to eliminate temptation in this way. How crazy are they, we exclaim. And then we would congratulate ourselves on being more sane than they. Though ironically, we still had within us all those same temptations and all that evil. The point, of course, is that sin comes from our heart, from choosing to follow the temptations of the flesh wherever we find them. And that sin is an affront to God's holiness, and it is such a great affront to it that it demands, no, it requires punishment and destruction in hell. We are in a desperate situation, and decisive action is required if we are to be saved. But if that drastic action is not plucking out of the eye or the cutting off of one's hand, what is it? Well, it is actually something far more dramatic and decisive. It is the giving up of one's complete self. It is the picking up of one's cross and following Jesus to Calvary, that with him you might die to self, but live to God. It is indeed considering yourself dead to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus. And this is drastic, and often appears so in this world. I find it ironic that I and the other crazies in the mental hospital found true followers of Jesus Christ to be crazy. I find it ironic that when, after a year in the hospital, I gave my life to Jesus and found myself clothed and in my right mind, the staff said for the first time that I was psychotic. Ironic. Yes, if you wish to deal with sin and to be saved from hell, you must take radical, decisive action. But that action is not the plucking out of an eye or the cutting off of a hand. It is the giving of your life, your all, to Jesus, and entrusting yourself to him and to his imputed righteousness for your future. And you may look crazy to those around you, but if you do this, you will have found life in the narrow way through the one who is the way, and you will be able to confidently say, the best is yet to come. God bless.